If I'd missed Harry Houdini's telephone call that night, I could have avoided all that ensued. The raid, the arrest, the flight, the bootlegging, and the sordid affair with the diamonds. In early June, he rang. I was glued to the crystal set, listening to Smith and Dale's comedy skit, Dr. Cronkite. Mom said the call was for me. I told her to take a message. Dr. Cronkite was looking down a patient's throat. Come now, say R. Open, please, open wider. I can't see a thing. Not one to give up, Dr. Cronkite kept up the exam. So now again, say R. Silence. Aha, I knew it, knew it. You know what, pleaded the patient. Was is it? You need glasses, Dr. Cronkite replied. Is that all? And that tongue of yours belongs in a delicatessen. When I heard that Harry had rung, I called back at once. He'd agreed to perform at a weekend party in Long Island and needed someone to assist with his act. James Collins, his regular assistant, was visiting family in Ireland. Would I be willing to help? Go, go, enjoy yourself, said Mom. So, on the Saturday, a steamy, perspiring morning, I found myself sitting next to Harry as we headed for Long Island. Harry and I had become thick when Mr. Courtney invited me to join his Thursday evening meetings in Brooklyn, where master locksmiths from all over the city convened in a local mortician's basement to discuss tricks of the trade. A faithful member of that group, Harry insisted on driving me because he didn't think the subways were safe. During those car rides, I heard all about Harry. At the time, he was 48 and had pretty much given up escapology for touring the circuses in a new act, debunking spiritualists. A short, muscular man with close-set eyes and black, wavy hair, he talked gruffly and ungrammatically, hated off-color jokes, and said he was born in Appleton, Wisconsin, though he came from Budapest. His real name was Erich Weiss, but not until years later did I learn that his father was a poor rabbi, reduced to supporting himself in a sweatshop cutting ties. Harry worshipped his mother, Cecilia Weiss, and not even Bess, his wife, mattered more. When talking about his mother, he would break down and weep. When she died, he was touring in Europe. In desperation, he tried to reach her through seances. There's a million of them cheating the public because of the war, he said on one of our drives. People want to be in touch with their kids who was killed. Although he never said so, I suspected that his crusade to have spiritualists banned was to punish the few who had taken in vain Cecilia Weiss's name. When I asked him to teach me some of his tricks, he agreed, explaining, for example, how mediums altered their voice with a speaking trumpet and created spirit hands, how they used an assistant or a switch attached to the table or floor to pipe in music through a vent, and how they called up secrets from somebody's past, a vaudeville act that always entertained me. I first tried that routine in Galena, Kansas, said Harry. It was summer. The air so heavy and hot, you needed an oxygen tent to survive. I went to all the cemeteries around town and copied names and dates from the headstones. Afterwards, I popped into the library, some library, and read through a lot of old newspapers. I even spent an afternoon sitting in the barber shop, getting my hair cut and listening to the local gossip, all the scandals and crimes. What a lot of hayseeds. The opera house was full. Half of them believed in seances, and the other half wanted to see for themselves all the hullabaloo. At first, I yakked about the spirit world. I closed my eyes. I opened them. I trembled. I said I could feel strange spirits in the air sending me messages. I named names, gave dates, told family secrets. Then I described the slit throat of someone who'd just been croaked. The opera house was in an uproar. People were screaming. A few fainted. Some bolted out the door. America's a country full of suckers. Out in the sticks, we got a saying. You know where Americans go after they've been suckered? Back again for more. As we drove over the bridge and headed for Northport, I hung on to my seat. A heedless driver, Harry would come up full steam on a stop and jam on the brakes. Often as not, he'd have one tire on the shoulder and one on the road. Speed seemed to excite him. The faster the car hurtled down the country roads of Long Island, the broader his smile became. He reminded me of a kid in a bumper car at Coney Island. But Harry drove a six-seater black Duesenberg that looked as long as a railroad car. The only thing missing was a porter. When you stepped into the Dues, you felt as if you were entering the Vanderbilt's living room. The cushy leather seats made me wish I had a coat cut from this stuff. Harry had rolled up the top, which gave us the appearance of royalty. As we passed through the city streets, I couldn't help but wonder how many car thieves were eyeing this chariot. With a top speed of 90, the car could overtake most everyone else on the road. Before long, we found ourselves stuck behind a long line of crawling catering trucks, all heading, I guessed, for the same place in Northport. Directly in front of us, a truck with the name Guralnik, Pears of Paradise, painted on the sides and back, inching along behind trucks bearing lawn rentals, poultry, fresh vegetables, dairy goods, and confections. A trunk near the front was inscribed, Wan Dim, lanterns, fireworks, candles, and incense. Close to noon, we pulled into a gravel drive that meandered for several hundred yards through maples and oaks before reaching a broad grassy field with stables and a garage that looked large enough to accommodate all the cars in Long Island. Two young men decked out in tuxedos and speaking with British accents came up to the car, offering to carry our equipment and cases. Harry asked about a dressing room close to the stage where he might store his trunk, as well as folding cabinet and portable table. The tuxes pointed to a tool shed that had been converted, they said, for exactly that purpose. "I hope you don't mind," said one of the Brits. "Don't worry," said Harry, laughing. "I've played in some towns where the theater was as small as this shed." The stage, a three-foot-high platform covered in canvas, stood between the house and the beach. Shouldering the luggage, the tuxes led us up to the house, a sprawling French-style chateau facing the water, and across the bay, Lily Gillespie's home. What a coincidence, I thought, as we followed the boys to the bedrooms which the owner of the house had set aside for us. Mine, decorated all in red, with upholstered couches and chairs and a desk, held an aquarium with exotic tropical fish swimming around pieces of coral and stones that glittered like diamonds. "I hope you like it, pal," said a voice from behind me. Turning around, I saw a man in white ducks and a blue sailing shirt. "Harry called to say that you'd be along." "It's nifty," I stupidly answered. "If you need anything, just ask. Have the run of the place." Just as magically as he had appeared, he vanished. When I saw Harry, I told him, "This joint has great help. Some fellow breezes in to welcome me and to say that you told him I'd be along and tells me to treat this place like my own." Harry chuckled with a knowing twinkle in his eye. For most of the afternoon, we practiced the act, in which Harry escapes from chains secured with a lock. We repeated my part until I could smoothly pass him a key unseen by the crowd. About 3:30, we'd finished rehearsing, so I went for a walk. The lawn buzzed with attendants, setting up tables and tents and stringing blue Chinese lanterns from the house to the beach. Caterers scurried from their trucks to the kitchen, hauling crates. Although the party wasn't scheduled to start until 5, A boisterous swimming crowd had already gathered down at the beach and were frolicking around the raft, which had chaise lounges, benches and chairs, two separate diving boards and three sets of steps. A hydroplane bobbed at anchor no more than 50 yards offshore, and a crowd of 9 or 10 young men were showing off for the silent screen actress soon to become famous as the It Girl, Clara Bow. A year older than I, Clara was madly chomping a wad of gum and teasing some of the boys.
Oh, Gwan, if you knew your onions like you was supposed to, you'd have known that movie kisses don't mean nothing.
I had read in Photoplay magazine that she'd flown from New York to the coast for a screen test with Metro.
I hope you're not one of them Minutemen. The minute you know a girl, you think you can kiss her.
She had eyes that would drag any worm from his book, and in just a few years her heart-shaped mouth would cause a million women to reshape their lips with pencils and dyes. While all these dream-making trappings enhanced recreation down the beach, at a boathouse and dock fit for a liner, two speedboats sat parked, looking like torpedoes ready for business, not fun. I saw the same hired hand who'd greeted me when I first arrived in my room walk from the speedboats to the head of the lawn, where he seemed to be eyeing the setting just like a big-shot director making a movie. I heard a voice say, "Don't be silly. He couldn't have croaked someone." They were talking about the owner of this sprawling estate, a person I still hadn't met. When I asked Harry the name of the guy, he said Rodman, and quickly added that bootleggers often use different names. For some reason, the sins of its owner made this estate seem especially magical. Before long, buffet tables littered the lawn, and a large orchestra with woodwinds and brass had begun to assemble. A portable bar rose out of the lawn with a genuine brass rail and three bartenders just an arm's reach away from imported gins and ryes and rums and liquors and beers and mixers and chasers and gingers and ales. The first man to reach the bar, a guy wearing a silk-checkered ascot and a pink shirt, toasted the Anti-Saloon League. "Here's to the sturdy people who ushered in Prohibition," he said, raising his glass. "Every criminal in America loves them. The dear old 18th Amendment, the maker of millions. Those poor blind buzzards. They think just cause the saloon at the corner is closed, America is dry. What a lot of dumb clucks." I saw Harry talking to Joe Frisco, the stuttering comic and dancer who was making quite a splash in the nightclubs. Harry and Joe were comparing notes about the rigors of performing in the sticks. "Outside of New York," said Harry, "it's all Bridgeport." Harry indicated that he wanted to talk to Frisco about the evening's performance, so I took a powder. Strolling to the top of the lawn, which gave me a clear view of the drive, I stood transfixed. Cars were pulling up right and left, parking every which way, as the sheikhs and shebers floated out of their roadsters like migrating moths in search of the light. A rainbow of colored dresses spilled out on the lawn. But for all their differences, the women all seemed like John Hell Jr.'s illustrations of flappers. Hair bobbed, foreheads concealed behind silk scarves tied to one side, chests flattened, waists narrowed, hips slimmed, skirts shortened to reveal stockinged legs as glossy as ivory. Some women had rolled their stockings above their knees. Some had garters, and some, special garters, holding flasks. They all shone with rouged cheeks, face powder, poisonously scarlet lips, mascara, and a pencil line in place of eyebrows. Even with all their makeup, they looked as if they were suffering from pallor mortis. Cigarettes dangled from their lips as they headed for the bar. In the sun, their gossamer dresses hung limply. Petticoats had fallen out of fashion, except among immigrant mothers and their children. I had to laugh, thinking of my Uncle Sam. I wished him the worst. The revelers were swinging and swaying. You could see they were warming up for the band. If my mother could have understood their brassy talk, she would have booked a boat back to Bremen. At school, Mrs. Lynch had shoved a bar of soap in my mouth for saying damn. I'd have needed a warehouse of detergents to handle this crowd, the women in particular. Hard-boiled. They were all quick with the comebacks and brittle repartee. One flapper, apparently, had just fought with her beau when he asked her spitefully, "You think you'll ever see me again?" She replied, "I should hope not, but unfortunately, accidents do happen." I could just hear my pop saying, "Now there's real class." Uprooting myself, I moved to the veranda. The man in white ducks and blue shirt had evaporated, probably to return to his post in the house. As I looked at the lawn and the beach and the dock, I felt the presence of someone else. Turning round, I found myself face to face with a handsome young man who introduced himself as Mr. Juniper. "It's a house," he said, indicating the Rodman estate with a sweep of his hand, "built for romance and wonder." He asked whether I'd met the owner. When I said no, he shook his head enigmatically. "There's something about him, a generosity, an innocence, even though he's a roughneck of sorts." Mr. Juniper dressed and spoke like a dandy. He gave me the impression that he couldn't make up his mind about his host. From what he said, I gathered that this fellow was himself a dreamer of sorts. "He invites me to his parties, though I'm not exactly sure why. I love the comings and goings and the fragile, tender nights that backdrop stolen kisses. The last innocence of this perishable age." "Perishable?" I asked. "All ages, but especially this one, with people living for the moment in the aftermath of a great war." The man had a way with words. "You see that place?" he said, pointing across the lawn at a neighbor's house with its thatched roof, timber frame walls, and a patchwork of brick, flint, and plaster. "Like this one, it expresses a hope. The hope of recovering the past. A Mr. Edward Fuller owned it, a man who loved Tudor architecture and glamorous parties." I knew that even though the Great War had dulled American enthusiasm for European culture, rich families were still building imitation French chateaux and miniature medieval castles and trying to lure indigent noblemen to marry their daughters for the sake of a title. But I had to admit that Mr. Fuller's house was beyond posh. The hold of the past on our imaginations comes from our inexhaustible desire for romance, Mr. Juniper said. Death and disease we filter out, toil and hardship disappear. Only the idea remains of youth, love, beauty, which we embellish with our infinite hope. Truths and facts have hardly a chance when we come up against dreams. Several voices caught our attention. Bill Fallon, who drove me down here, said the party was being thrown by a fellow named Rodman. Fits, with all the gangsters around. I've never yet been to a party in the last 2 years when there weren't at least two bootleggers, an alderman, and a cop. Don't you just love Prohibition? It's all so delicious. On that tasty note, Mr. Juniper and I left the veranda. He headed for the bar, and I returned to the house. Passing through the dining room, which resembled a medieval hall, I strolled into the parlor. The layout of this astonishing house made me think of a string of boxes decreasing in size. The immense dining room, the parlor, the library, and finally a yet smaller room, which I was soon to discover. Upon entering the library, I found two men anxiously talking, seemingly oblivious to me. One sported a mustache. The other was devouring a large piece of cake. I eavesdropped. "Where's the stuff stashed?" "In a fishbowl." "You serious?" "I never kid about rocks." "Then I'll see you down at the dock. Not a minute later than 2 a.m., so don't get distracted." "Not a chance," said the mustache, and he pushed open a door that had been painted to look like a bookcase and left. The second man put his half-filled glass of milk and empty cake plate on top of a dictionary and walked over to one of the bookcases. I could see that in the reflection of the glass bookcase, he was admiring a mouthful of teeth that came not from Mother Nature, but from a dentist. He took a swallow of milk. "It's for my stomach. Indigestion. Milk's healthy." "You suppose the guy who owns this place has read all these books?" I asked. "Hank? Not a chance. But don't get me wrong. He's deep. Went to the Sorbonne in Paris." The library was lined with glass cases, most of them locked. The few that were not contained mostly reference books, things like a world atlas, a set of 1912 Britannicas, Roget's Thesaurus, Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, How to Build a Better Vocabulary in 30 Days, Parliamentary Speeches, a book of synonyms, a French dictionary, and numerous bound copies of Scientific American magazine. The locked cases held books ranging in interest from cooking and gardening to philosophy and history. The complete works of Kant stood next to selections from Aristotle. I saw multi-volume histories of England and America and the collected notes and diaries of famous explorers, the complete novels of Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, George Eliot, and Anthony Trollope, and French editions of Balzac, Flaubert, and Zola. All these books, according to a note affixed to the bookcase, were bound alike in half-rust Morocco, inlaid with light brown leather, tooled with gold on the upper and lower covers, and edged with gilt. The collection reminded me of the libraries of wealthy homes featured in the Sunday papers. "What brings you here, miss?" "I'm a locksmith."
"On a job?"
Yeah, but I can't talk about it."
"Really?"
he said with some surprise. The man with the manicured mustache stuck his head round the door.
"Must see you."
Grabbing what remained of his food, the toothy man remarked as he left,
"A guy can't even finish his milk."
Alone in the library, I saw a number of books on American exploration. I'd occasionally read about those European voyages, seeking new routes to spices and gold, or to some place called Eden, braving the Atlantic and rivers in flood, pushing through dense forests and driving across vast arid wastes. The De Sotos and La Salles must have found in this fresh new world a land commensurate with their dreams. Suddenly, I could imagine myself floating down the Missouri with Lewis and Clark, paddling a canoe on the Mississippi with Zebulon Pike, and running the rapids in Grand Canyon with John Wesley Powell. I remembered my father saying that these men were seeking a passage to their own private India, but found instead the Pacific. He was skeptical of dreamers. "That was then," he said. "Now the country has been mapped and pillaged, and still our restless spirit yearns to discover America. In place of birch bark canoes and rafts and pack mules and compasses, we navigate the new world with education and wealth. Is it any wonder the country is rife with door-to-door booksellers hawking the wonderland of knowledge, and extortionists, revivalists, and thieves stealing in every conceivable way?" As I admired the library, I wondered what to make of these books with the hundreds of matched bindings. Surely the owner was someone who wished to find in the stories and facts a knowledge of history and self. All across America, people were talking about the value of school and the importance of knowing a trade. But because the task of learning is so daunting, most people seek shortcuts through a command of vocabulary or elocution or religious texts. But on that day in June, in the Gothic library of a grand Norman house, my reflections gave way to the realization that the map of America on the far wall disguised a door handle. To my utter amazement, it led to a private room, the heart of the house.